All right, then, I think we should probably get started. So this is our first shot at seeing how are these discussion sections go. So I'm also graciously agreed to kick it off. And so I think the idea here is to have a much more interactive, not that our talks aren't also interactive, but there'll be more flexibility in our time. But the idea really is that the initiator of the discussion will not give a necessarily formal talk, but will be giving some initial food for thought. And that maybe there are some questions, maybe there's some answers that hopefully not know. And let's see how it goes. So.
Yes. Well, I should really say that the answer is no here. The answer I mean. So thanks for pointing that out. And actually, so on Monday we had this idea that we would have a discussion on quantum many body and reservoir engineering and non-Markov stuff. I mean, something related to that. And then, so I said, maybe have something to say to from some angle in this direction. And then yesterday there was this talk by Hendra explaining how to adiabatically eliminate. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, but I do not want to adiabatically eliminate. And I want to explain why I do not want that. And so this is about wiggles. So wiggles are very important in my life. So I have a few transparencies which show you why I love wiggles and how I would like to preserve them. And if you are diabetically eliminate, wiggles are quick, so you wash them away and then I'm jobless. So this would be bad. So now here is what my outline. So I want to show few wiggles in classical situation, then more wiggles in classical in quantum control. Then I want to show you how this relates to noise, both classical noise and also quantum noise in the sense of non-Markov system. And then I want to tell you what happens if I cut off some of these wiggles, but not all of them. And then I will come back to the idea that wiggles are some primitives for the control. And this is actually an idea that was asked the first time by David Tanner 3 years ago in this workshop. And then I have done some homework, and then we have come up with some ideas to use. Classical control. So here is a thing that does something non-trivial without feedback, okay, and it is stable. So whenever you go to your experimental friend and they will complain that your control is too funny, too delicate, too whatever, no, this is robust. And this is a Kapitza pendulum. Okay, we know that, very trivial. So you have a pendulum which, you know, normally would fall down, but then if you, you know, just wiggle it up and down, then it gets stable because you can touch it and you can displace it and it still will be stable in a position that is really non-trivial for a system which is non-driven. And I like this because really, I mean, just going up and down here is all you need. And it is not about feedback. It is, I do something non-trivial just by shaking my system. So here is really what we can do is also in quantum control. I mean, my pedestrian picture of quantum optimization is about interference. So I have some certain system with time, energy levels change. I can have some avoided crossings here where, you know, I'm at a risk of populating upstairs due to Landau-Zener crossing. So if I go adiabatic very slowly, I can stay next to the ground state. And on the other hand, if I want to do it quick, I can squeeze the time. It will go in principle quicker, but of course I am at risk of shooting up because here in this Landau-Zener crossing I'm going up. I want to do optimal control. I shake, so here is my wiggles. In the beginning, I do some excitation in the beginning, higher energy, and then it converges down here because there is some interference. Trivial, everybody in this field more or less has in their mind a picture similar to this. I think, I expect, I believe, maybe not. Well, here, that was a cartoon. So this is instead, and this is my first sort of menu. Yeah. So this is a let's say, few-body system in the sense that it is a Lipkin model. It is a model in which you have all spins coupled to each other, and you have an external magnetic field driving a transition between a state with all of them polarized in some transverse direction to all of them polarized in some vertical direction. And here it is not a cartoon in the sense that, you know, here you do have this avoided crossing here in the energy level scheme, because if the more spins you will have, the smaller this gap will be. But still, you know, I can do my adiabatic strategy and stay close to the ground state. If I go linear but quick, I should up the energy, and my optimal procedure brings me to the ground state on one hand, to the ground state on the other hand, by just doing some big excitation and then wiggling around and going down. Okay, so that's with my system.
Why does your ground state have the arrows pointing to the right? It would make sense. This is an Ising model of some kind, right? So
no, it is a Liefeld model.
No, but I mean the spin sigma these are Pauli matrices.
Yes.
So what does that mean to have an arrow pointing to the side?
Sigma x.
So it's the ground. So sigma x is
the ground state at one end.
So that's the eigenvalue of sigma. That's what you mean by that, is the eigenvalue of sigma x. Okay. Eigenstate of sigma x.
In what sense is that optimal? Is it time optimal?
No, it is optimal in the sense that I minimize the population outside of the ground state, and I am trying to do it quick in the sense that I'm doing it in a time which is non-adiabatic, in the sense that the time is of the order of this inverse gap here.
And is it more optimal than adiabatic in some sense in terms of the break the fraction that you get here, or the time?
Not in the fraction, but in the time, in the sense that the time here is maybe two orders of magnitude quicker than adiabatic, right?
So,
and then, yeah.
So what exactly was your cost function?
My cost function is population here.
Only the final time?
Only the final time. Mm-hmm. So I can allow anything in between. And actually, I mean, there is stuff, I will come back probably, I will contribute, I didn't want to put everything here. So this is related for me to this quantum speed limit stuff. So I can see there is even a universal scaling of the final fidelity I can get as a function of the time. And there is a universal scaling for this and for other. I can, you know, do a Grover adiabatic algorithm and try to do the same process. And I get infidelity as a function of time, which scales really universally with a cosinus function, as a function of some action parameter, which is my gap here multiplied by the total time in which I'm trying to do it. But this is not really what I planned. It is not for the discussion. But yeah.
Can I ask a question, even if it's not for the discussion?
Yes.
How crucially does this depend upon Jij on the couplings between the spins?
Not crucially.
You make it nearest neighbor, does it still work?
Yes. We did it like this because it was somehow, everything is coupled, it is more coupled, so to say. Right?
Jake? So I'm just awfully confused because.
Very good.
I don't know what your bottom axis is.
My bottom axis is.
It's clearly not T over T.
Is T over T, and the time is. I'm changing. I'm having a certain pulse shape, right? So
then how is it faster?
It is faster because, so what I choose, my optimal control is, I am choosing a certain time dependence for this time.
Yeah, I get that, but if capital T is the same, then how is it any faster to do one or the other?
No, of course. So capital T is the same for the red and the green curve,
yeah.
And for this guy here, so T is different for each of these curves.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. And then a second question.
Sorry?
Second question.
Okay.
On one side, you have the twofold degenerate ground state.
Yeah.
On the other side, you have a single ground state. So where'd the other state go?
Is it twofold degenerate in the...
Like gamma is equal to zero, it's twofold degenerate.
No, but...
Maybe I misunderstand it, but...
Maybe we should...
No, yeah, it's zero. Where does the other go? I wouldn't be able to answer that now.
Yeah, I think it's because J is not just nearest neighbor.
Yeah,
you can actually just discuss everything first on a line.
Yes.
When I'm nearest neighbors, then you know
Yes.
But then this is a lithium ion. J is a constant in this case, isn't it?
J is a constant and gamma is a field of magnetic state.
I mean, it's a completely connected graph.
Good. Now okay. Thanks.
The reason why we are doing this is if you do it Ising, as I said before, Ising is some sort of simpler, okay, it is nearest neighbors. We wanted to show we can drive something which is completely connected. And the purpose I'm showing it here is just to say, just to illustrate, I mean, I have a lot of more transparencies in my normal talks here. I picked some which go to the wiggle point, so to say. Somehow I gave up giving a longer talk because, of course, you have one slot over the workshop, and so this is my slot. So I gave up some transparencies, but.
But it really means that t equals zero, you choose as an initial state all spins in sigma x.
Yes. And this is the ground state of my Hamiltonian in the beginning, and then I end up.
Is it degenerate?
No, I don't think so. No, because again, this guy maps to a huge spin. Okay, so the ground state is everybody down, which maps to this.
It's just kx squared.
Yeah. I think it is not usual because it is lit. And what concerns me here is, I mean, this is not a cartoon, it is the type of dynamics that we have, and it works also for many body systems. So the type of scheme that I showed before is not just for a localized few level system, but it is for general body system. Okay. So here is, and here is just to say, it works, optimal control works, it works also for many body systems. Lipkin is special. To get it work for general systems, we have to develop something else that I will show in a minute. Now I'm coming back to an example with a few bodies to show really what these wiggles do in detail. Okay? So here's an example. This is for some quantum gate that I want to achieve. Quantum gate here is irrelevant in the sense that what I want to discuss is the process I want is I have two particles, left and right. What I want to do is I bring the left particle, which was in the ground state in the left well, to the right vertex side state. Okay? I can do that adiabatically, I can speed it up. Again, why do I want to do that? So my motivation is that if I do this, then I can switch on some interaction and get some quantum gate. But what matters in terms of the wiggles is this transition here, from left to right. So here is first evidence that this process can be done slowly. This has been done by Bill Phillips and Trey Porto a few years ago, based on this idea that we had. So here is experimental data, here is their potential, how they modulate it, and then suddenly appears, well, now it was the reverse, it started right at 20 meters exact left. Here are experimental data showing that really the blue red zones correspond to from going to a ground state to going to a process state. They have realized 1-2-qubit gate, not exactly at the time that we proposed, but 1-2-qubit gate in 2007 in Nature, based on this idea here. And now what I want to focus on for my wiggle discussion is really, they do it in a few milliseconds, can I do it quicker or significantly quicker? So how can I do that? Well, first I have to look at the adiabatic connection diagram. So again, this is the energy level diagram as a function of time or of my standard parameter here. So in the first, I have a first quick stage in which I just bring this level up, okay, by tilting, making the double asymmetric, so that I have a non-avoided crossing. I have a real crossing, so this level here goes above this one, and they don't talk to each other because the barrier is high, so there is no time. And then I modify the shape of this guy so that this level, which now will be higher than this, adiabatically follows and ends up where I wanted it to be. Okay? And at the same time, the other atom stays where it is, so down here. Okay? And I design these adiabatic curves in such a way that they are as parallel as possible during the transition, so that you know this guy stays here and the other guy goes up. And this is basically the idea that they used for doing this this process adiabatically. Now I want to optimize. I use one of my optimal control algorithms. There is no need to explain in detail. It is a gradient algorithm. It is due to Krotov. What I get is this. So the optimization, so I have two parameters. Asymmetry in the well, I can tilt the guy, and then I have to lower the barrier. This is exactly what they did in the experiment. So somehow, you know, I lower the barrier and I make the guy asymmetric. What does my optimization algorithm do? It introduces some, you know, wiggles here. Some little shaking and unshaking, which is what when the two atoms are next to the tunneling process, but the barrier is not yet so low, it gives you this additional kick, this additional energy, which allows one atom, helps one atom to go to the other side. And of course, it has to be done in a controlled way, in the sense that you want it to come in exactly the state you wanted. So this is not really just some oscillation that you can design by hand. It is something that you have to find.
When you talk about the atom moving, I mean, you're thinking about actually wave packets, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So these are quantum interference effects, or?
Exactly. In fact, in my first slide, in this cartoon that I showed when I have the excitation and then it goes to the ground state, this is an interference effect, because they have different excitations, but with the right phases, so in the end, they go down very well, actually, right? So, okay, so important is, I have these wiggles, this shaking helps move the guys in the direction I want them to move. Here's my usual, tray waiter example, which probably everyone of you has heard 20 times, so I'm not going to redo it. But the important point here, as concerning noise, is that the frequency of these guys here is higher, definitely higher than the whole operation of the process. And this is relevant when we are going to look for noise. Okay, because here I can have noise in the controls, or maybe, like for instance, in a superconducting system, here is something that I am completely ignorant in, which is why I collaborated with Saro Fazio, who knows these things. We took a postdoc, we put him in a cardboard box, we shipped him to Carl Schön in Karlsruhe, and so he got knowledge how you can really, do really one over F noise with hundreds of microscopic fluctuators and everything. It was very kosher. And so what happens is I have a red line with wiggles, which gives me certain gain, which is appropriate for this Cooper-Pair coupling circuit, and this is the red line, big wiggle and smaller wiggles, and then the noisy line, okay, due to noise in the superconducting circuit, because this thing is solid state, is something that is distorting even maybe significantly my curve here. And one may ask, okay, what will happen now? Normally, my experimental friends say, oh, your control is very delicate, so it won't work. And so you have to see, as a function of the amplitude of that noise, what is the fidelity, right? What is the error, in other words? So this noise is 1 over f noise, so it has a certain amplitude A, and as a function of this amplitude, I can plot the error that I can get in my gauge. And of course, if I have very strong noise, 100% somehow noise, I make 100% error. If I have very small noise, in the limit of zero noise, of course, there is a difference between optimizing and non-optimizing. So I can gain almost 2 orders of magnitude in fidelity. And the question is, where is going this, the real number to be? And Murphy's law, of course, predicts that the real number will be somewhere around here, so that the answer is no, it doesn't work. But in reality, the typical values are 10 to the minus 5 for this guy, and so here in the region in which I can have, even with the real noise, distorting my signal, as I showed before, I can still have this significant improvement here. Right?
Sorry, I forgot, what is
the epsilon mid? This is the error after the gate. So I want this to be small. This is the infidelity in my quantum gate. Jake has a question? Okay. Yeah. Okay, please.
Oh, yeah. Why do you just have 1 over omega? Why not some power? Do you know why you have just 1 over omega noise? I mean, power.
This
1 over F noise.
1 over F noise is, at least my sort of understanding.
Can be any power.
Sorry?
Can be any power, right?
I guess, yeah. So what we implemented here is 1 over F, because this, at least according to gurus, theoretical gurus in that field, is one, valid simulation of realistic noise there. And this is not going to change if I have other powers.
Okay.
Unless this is a very, singular or extreme case. So this is a really typical situation.
Can you
explain
solid state?
Solid state?
One, two. So one is very, very common.
Yeah,
so
very common, but it's not universal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, you're right. But it's
It's very common. This is one very common example. And what I'm telling you is we checked also with other examples, you know, more or less. We did it even with white noise at some point, and still, this feature here exists. Okay, there is a certain stability. And the idea is, when you talk to quantum control gurus, is you are sitting in a minimum, you move away from the minimum, somehow, things do not change too much. Okay, this is a hand-waving argument. So, yes.
What about phase noise?
We didn't consider that here.
What's that?
We didn't take that into account.
So, I have some minor concern that I immediately address, which is that I'm doing this slow thing in the previous case, and then I turn the wiggles on.
Yes.
And what happens if I get the phase wrong and you turn the wiggles on?
Thinking if we ever took a calculation and something in which we explicitly showed that this is not so bad, we have considered the distortions in which we cut the spectrum. I will show that later, and that has also an influence on the phase of the wiggles. And so I can say that I do not expect a big impact from that, but I would not be able to tell you one calculation in which we address specifically that problem. Maybe we would have to do it. My standard version of this talk is a list of complaints like that, which we show that all of them can be addressed. And indirectly, I would say that this is no big concern. Okay, I'm not sure in this case, I cannot claim we've done it, but I will show later what distortions can do in these videos. So the question is, you have some sort of realistic noise, which is typical in solid state systems, and here fault tolerance can be seemingly achieved in this case. So why does it work? Well, of course, one can say there is noise frequency separation, right? So here is a very noisy process. This is the Titanic on some night after hitting some iceberg. And we know that there was a very non-trivial control task going on there because the band was playing. So you die happily because you hear Mozart. The fact that you can hear Mozart is non-trivial because, there is huge dynamics here. This movement is kind of bigger than the movement of fingers of people here. Maybe at this point you don't hear much more Mozart, but anyway, depending on where they sit. But you can have a huge, movement, and still, why do you hear Mozart? Because if you look in detail, there are some wiggles here. There are some things moving with a frequency which is different than the whole thing. Of course, if a hammer, a pneumatic hammer, this thing is hammering next to you, or someone is taking your hand and shaking it, then you don't do Mozart anymore. And at this point, certainly not. But if there is, even if there is a lot of energy going on, okay, but the frequency scale is different, you can still get pretty decent happiness level while you are singing. So there is a frequency separation. So somehow I want to show this because this tells me, high frequencies can be helpful, and they can be, in some cases, the decisive point that helps me achieve in a quicker time and doing a better job in a shorter time. But of course, this is classical noise. So I also promised I have some quantum noise, some example of non-Markovian noise. And again, I'm not an expert in this, so I collaborate with people who can do these things. And here the idea is I have a system, it is coupled to a reservoir, and as usual, I want to control it, and I have some objective. In this case, my system will be a harmonic oscillator coupled to a bath with some spectral function of this kind here. And what I can do, my control, is I can parametrically excite the guy, so I can change the frequency. And initially, my system is in thermal equilibrium with the bath. And what I want to do is I want, just by massaging the guy, I want to shake entropy out of it. Okay? So basically, I want to cool it down with respect to cool it to a lower entropy than environment. Can I do that? Well, So here are different possibilities for my calculation. I can do a rotating angular approximation, basically equivalent to having a Markov system, in the sense that I deal with my system as if it was forgetting immediately what anything that is going to the bath. And in this case, I get the red curves for my controls. Okay, and these curves are all more or less flat. And here is a short time Fourier transform, a window Fourier transform as time evolves. Here I have my Fourier transform, which basically is similar. The result that I get from the optimal control algorithm with dissipation or without dissipation is more or less the same. And of course, the result you get with dissipation is then worse. But if I properly take into account in the stochastic Hilbert phenomenon approach the dissipation in this non-Markovian bath, what I get is actually that the entropy goes down. So here are the curves that I obtain by optimizing with a sort of approximately Markovian system. Entropy in my oscillator goes up. Instead, if I take properly into account the memory in the reservoir, entropy goes down. For me, this means, coming back to the interference picture, right? We need to have interference. It means that if my bath is not forgetting instantly, so the amplitude, something that goes to the bath, is not being forgotten instantly, I can still catch it up. I can, if I act quicker than the memory time, I can still undo some of this thing. I can still have the system and bath interfere with itself and get something out of it, non-trivial. But of course, for doing that, I need to be quicker than the bath, which is why, for me, at least naively, after yesterday's discussion, this is an example where I would not want to do a diabatic elimination, because if I did, I would lose this feature. So, and this is sort of my question, for at least my thought provoking, at least for me, question maybe for everybody's answer is trivial, how this can be relevant in non-Markovian systems. So, and then I have a part on using these windows as primitives. So, what I can see if I cut them off, if I have even some phase noise, if I distort my signal. So, here is it is something we did with Daniel a few years ago. The purpose here, it is again not very relevant, it was still kind of neat, but we have an array of qubits which are not controlled. We want to do universal quantum computation in here, then any gate among these two qubits, any two qubits in the string, we can control only two qubits in the beginning. We can do a Hadamard gate here, and we can change the magnetic field talking to the first qubit. Can we do universal quantum computing? Yes, we can. This works with sort of generic model XX, XY, and so on. Important thing is, again, I have wiggles, many, many wiggles, complicated, relatively smooth on the time scale of the inverse coupling between my uncontrolled spins. The way it scales with the length of the chain is only quadratical. Okay, so, I want to do quantum gate between qubit 13 and qubit 47. I have a certain shape here, and I do that. And the length of this pulse only grows quadratically with the length of my chain. Again, complicated pulse. What happens if I have distortions? Well, here is the spectrum. If I cut off pieces from the spectrum, what happens is I can still look at the fidelity, and for a cutoff down to here, or maybe a little lower than the typical frequency of related to the coupling between the spins, I still have unit fidelity. So I can get rid of a lot of these frequencies, I can get rid of a lot of these features, I can distort the pulse a lot, and it still works. Why does it? I'm not sure, and I would like to ask some experts why this is. This is really, that NMR people have very nice names for their algorithms, like animals and plants. So we thought we should come up with a nice animal name. But we forgot we are in Germany. And there is a little pronunciation problem there. And so this is the CRAB algorithm, which means a chopped random basis optimization. And chopped random basis means I have a basis of functions, and I chop it. I throw away some components. So it starts with some initial guess here as time dependence. I want to update it, and I update it in terms of a few basic functions, which could be, you know, some wiggles, some sinusoidal functions, and I have a sum over a few such functions which updates my pulse of the order of 4, 5, 10 such components. So in terms of landscapes, which will be a theme further on in the workshop, I have maybe a landscape in terms of some fidelity or error cost function as a function of a few parameters. And then I can use a simplex method. Here I don't need to use gradient, I use a simplex method, and I get some initial values there, and then I let my polytop roll down, and here I have a pulse which has some specified properties in terms of frequencies and so on, so some wiggles that I said in the beginning, which kind of wiggles I want, and I don't need the gradient, I don't need the analytical solution, I can do this for any cost function. To convince people, I mean, people didn't believe that, so to convince people, we did a simulation with the Bozabad model, yeah, where you start with a superfluid and an optical lattice, a Bose-Einstein condensate, you raise the optical lattice, and you want to end up with one atom per lattice site here. You can have defects if you do it non-adiabatically. You want to do it strongly non-adiabatically, but still have no defects and have a nice quantum register here with one atom per lattice site. Do that. Well, we start with our unwiggled pulse shape for ramping up the optical lattice. We modify it by a crab, changes a little bit, you know, some wiggling around, not too much. And what we get is, compare the two, I mean, this is almost two orders of magnitude quicker than they do experiments normally. Compare the two what they have normally here, which would be with traditional, conventional pulse shapes, you would have errors in the order of 10% and up. We can get errors in the order of 10 to the minus 3. And people, of course, didn't believe, so there are people now doing experiments. Emmanuel Bloch, 2 weeks ago, did an experiment in which they saw that with respect to the already refined technique they have to load lattices, with our pulses, they can visibly reduce defect density. There are very preliminary data. I am not showing them because my point here is wiggles. We can discuss that with anybody who wants, but I mean, here is a gap that is there and comes from wiggles. So my question is, do we really need to adiabatically eliminate? So is there something in quick dynamics that can help? In a many-body situation, this is a many-body situation, you can only do, this is the only existing quantum optimal control algorithm that allows you to deal with a quantum many-body system exactly simulated. Okay? We are using it also for other systems like quantum biology. We have a collaboration with Bepita on this. It is surprising that if I have a few more frequent Fourier components, I mean, the final fidelity decays exponentially as a function of the amount of the number of components they put in there. And we don't really know why this is the case, but it seems that these sort of quick things are helpful both in non-Markovian systems. My intuitive explanation is the one I said. It helps also in many-body systems. And well, this is a sort of you know, some of the question marks that we have related to this. Thank you.
So, go ahead.
Now, this is not a talk, so you're not supposed to clap your hands.
I have two comments, which hopefully will lead to questions.
Very good.
So let me start with the less controversial comment, which is about the utility of wiggles. So many years ago, at an optimal control workshop organized by, I think, you and a few other people at Harvard, I learned about why Rabi notation works so well, which is to say, in control theory, oscillating a small perturbation at appropriate frequency is a more optimal approach for generating complete control than doing sort of digital pulsing something on and off.
And we did this nice tiny track paper.
So it seems to me that the answer to your question, why do wiggles work so well, is the same as the answer to the question, why does Rabi notation work so well? Which is simply that you get better control for the same power by oscillating at a higher frequency, and you're using your Hamiltonian to generate other parts of the group. So that's just it's conjecture, of course, but I, and I'm the wrong person to follow through in that conjecture because it's not my field, but But I feel like this is somehow the answer.
Okay.
So that's the first comment. Second comment, I think that the definition of adiabatic illumination you used yesterday and the definition in your talk today are different. And in particular, your wiggles are a fast degree of freedom.
Yes.
Mathematically, once you eliminate them, you will get a slow problem. And that slow problem will reflect the benefit of the wiggles having been put in. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, it seems like maybe the friction, the sort of conflict that you're focusing on, it has to do with time-independent and time-dependent systems.
Okay, that's quite possible.
Because here the point is that it's a time-dependent system with fast oscillations. And if I was, you know, just trying to solve the problem, I would then adiabatic eliminate the fast oscillations, which would give me the dynamics I want, like the Rabi mutation or whatever it is you're aiming for.
I guess my understanding, but maybe I'm too naive, is this would be the right picture if my wiggles would be, you know, just some simple sinusoids. Yeah? In the sense that I could say I get now an effective description of my problem in which I have different couplings among states. And those different effective couplings take into account that there was in a physical situation some fast oscillating thing, right? However, I'm not entirely sure, not in the sense that the answer is no, but really I'm not sure how much this would apply here, because the experience here is in some cases, like our work we did on penning traps, you just put up on it superimposes some fast oscillation and everything works, but this is not generic. In most cases, you know, your pulse shape needs to be not infinitely complex, but also not as simple as just a sinusoidal, okay? And it can tolerate a certain amount of phase noise between different components. Actually, the R, this crab, is random, so there is a certain freedom in there, but you still need some sort of, you know, correlation between the different amplitudes. And I'm not entirely sure how that would or could be captured by, I mean, the important question is not a diabatic elimination per se, but I'm not sure how much that would be captured by a diabatic elimination. On the other hand, I mean, the more general question is, if we have non-Markov, yeah, maybe we need finely structured pulse in time to achieve something better. And actually, I mean, this, I thought until a few months ago that this was some pure theory, and then in the Utrecht experiment it wouldn't work. But now, to my astonishment, there are several groups doing that. Immanuel Bloch is doing that, it's working. Massimiliano Gucci is doing that in closed loop, it is working. Jörg Schmidmeier did an experiment in single trap, it is working. Fyodor Iletko did it with diamonds, it is working. There must be something there. And this is short time dynamics.
Yes.
You're using these wiggles with high frequency. Does that mean that you access the higher state, the higher energy?
That is correct. In fact, this brings me back to the initial picture, the cartoon, where it's going up, because it is really, I am pumping energy in there, so I am exciting. Okay. Also, in the non-cartoon picture with the Lipkin model, I have the optimized curve which shot up in the beginning because I'm pumping energy, and I'm doing it in a certain controlled way, which means I'm having some excitations.
That you are using your higher energy states to be more effective.
Yes.
When you go from A to B.
So maybe I should really use, maybe with apologies to those who have already heard that, I should really maybe do my little waiter sketch.
Good.
So what's the waiter? So we have a session here, and Ivan is sitting there. He's my chairman. He wants to cut my time. I want more time. I want 1 hour more time. And here I have a source of cold champagne. And I can, if I serve this champagne cold enough to Ivan, I will be able to get more done. So I prepare my system, and it's ground state. I have a tray with the champagne flutes, yeah? And in there is a very cold champagne. And now I'm an untrained waiter, so I will move adiabatically towards Ivan because I want to give him all the champagne, okay? And this is very slow. So by the time I'm there, the champagne, due to interaction with environment, is very warm. He spits it in my face, and I don't get my minutes. So I try again. I go here to my source, I prepare my system, and now I say, I want to do it quicker. So what do? I mean, I have less time, let's try something. I start with a linear ramp. So I start with my guy and I go like this. And by the time I'm in the middle of the room, my fidelity has dropped, in the sense that half of my glasses are on the floor, because I have had some excitation, which is not really the one that helps me, okay? So now, since I'm a learning system, I'm a physics professor, even though a theoretician, I can learn some things. I take private lessons. So I go to a waiter. In the meantime, the session has expired, but it doesn't matter. So I go to a waiter, a real waiter, and I learn how they do. And if you observe what a real waiter will do, they do the following. They start with the tray, and then they incline it, and then they go, and then they decline it like this. Okay? And this is a little bit like all this inverted pendulum, which you can do with feedback, whatever. And the point relevant to this is I am excited, yes, I'm excited a lot in the beginning, okay? I have sloshing motion, but then I can do the, undo the sloshing motion if I use in a combined way on all my parameters. Of course, I cannot just tilt my tray because then the fidelity goes to the floor instantly, but if I tilt my tray and then I go and then I undo it, I have excitation, but this is exactly what I need to get my 20 minutes more.
No, but I mean, why do wiggles work so well? That's because you can use many more different paths.
Yes. Yeah. And because there is quantum interference, and by the way, quantum systems are not non-linear, which means chaotic, which means I have little changes in initial conditions and it leads to divergently distant final conditions. Quantum systems are linear, okay? Which means even if I don't do it exactly as I should be doing it, it still works, which is one explanation for this robustness here.
Maybe I can add a comment in here. Also, that's not necessarily directed just to Tommaso, but because I think from the point of view of the discussion, it's also for everyone. I'm struck by when I see this also, and this is really a question, something I don't know much about, and I wonder what the group thinks about it. This reminds me of the idea of the stochastic resonance, which I've never understood. I mean, I don't know if anyone understands or can explain or thinks that stochastic resonance is a useful concept, but the idea of stochastic resonance, somehow you add noise into a system and it makes it more robust or it allows it to achieve a certain transition that it wouldn't achieve it if there wasn't noise. Is this anything like a stochastic resonance? Does anyone know what a stochastic resonance is? And what do you think, Hans?
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, for me, a stochastic resonance is a short term for a class of phenomena. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a deep theory that, you know, it is a situation where you have a system with, say, many local minima, where you don't necessarily want your system to get trapped into. So if you have no noise whatsoever, this is the situation that there's a danger that the system gets trapped in some parameter space where you don't want it to be. So if you add a little noise, that frees the system and shakes it a bit so it can move on in its evolution. Now clearly, if you add too much noise, you will totally confuse it and you will deviate too much from its path. In that sense, you will always get, if you have a figure where you have the x-axis would be the noise level, and there is some fidelity measure of how fast you would reach your goal, whatever, then you would have some resonance. I think for me, it's just, you know.
So it's like annealing in some sense, but with, like you don't get trapped in local minima.
I think that is the essential thing, at least for me, but I don't
know. Isn't it so that's the signature noise? Isn't that one of the points with stochastic resonance, that you can enhance the signature noise?
That's what I thought, that part of you get, that without the noise, you wouldn't be able to, you would not have the signal to.
But that noise is different. Some
system you would like to measure some characteristic frequency, and then you add noise. and then the signal to noise can actually be enhanced. But well, it is a classical, I think it's a classical phenomenon because nonlinearities.
Yeah, there have been some discussions of quantum stochastic resonances, but I've never understood if this is a meaningful. Anyway, just an aside, but John, you had a comment.
It struck me that your initial question is a loaded question, right?
What does it mean, a loaded question?
You know, when did you last beat your wife, that type of question. The operative word here that I'm struggling with is we. Who's we?
Oh, very nice. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so from the point of view of someone who wants to do open loop control, then possibly adiabatic elimination is not the way to go. Seeing as this is a jumping point from yesterday's talk, the Hendricks talk, the goal was to do model reduction, typically with a view to doing closed loop control, introducing feedback, right? Now, if you look at modern engineering, I may have to defer to Matt who's just come in, there's very, very few instances in classical control engineering where you'd actually rely purely on open loop. It's mostly feedback, right? And when you're doing things classically, you can use very simple models quite robustly, and you can quantify the robustness, and you don't get too carried away by the fact that there are unmodeled non-linearities in your model, because you know you can deal with those robustly, or disturbances, or noise, or unmodeled uncertainties, largely because of the way feedback works. And the whole advantage of adiabatic elimination is coming down to a simpler model. That's what we were doing yesterday, model reduction. And this is a general feature of what you get qualitatively when you do introduce feedback. So the answer to your question is, do we really need adiabatic elimination? It depends on, are we looking to do open loop control, or are we looking to do closed loop control? Will feedback feature? And if feedback features, then it's quite possible that to get a simple yet robust model for a system, you can ignore the fast degrees of freedom. Of course, the effect that there are fast degrees of freedom will have some effective contribution to the final model, as we saw in what presented, right? That the reduced open dynamical system does contain some information about what's been going on in the fast degrees of freedom. But it's a general feature of what happens when you do closed loop control, that model reduction, throwing out unnecessary degrees of freedom, and reducing just to a smaller set, more tractable set, is something which you can do generally quite well. I don't know if you...
I have three comments to that.
Yeah.
The first is that this type of comment is really the reason why I traveled all the way to Santa Barbara. And this is really the type of thing which for me makes such a discussion worth, because it comes from an entirely different world, and this is something I would never think myself, and this is why I'm excited to have these discussions here. Okay, first thing. Second thing, and maybe I'm very naive, and, well, no, the very naive is the third one. The second thing is, what does we mean? We means quantum engineers, okay? In the sense that Seth Lloyd means it, meaning all of us as people, you know, play with quantum systems and trying to do things with them, okay? And so that, in my view, encompasses both you and myself in this broad sense. And the third, which is maybe very naive, is what I presented was open loop. I mentioned quickly that there is a closed loop version of that, which is not a quantum closed loop, okay? But what we see is that basically I can use this crab. Some people, like in Florence, they are doing experiments with BEC on that. You can use crab and replace the simulation, yeah? Which tells me I have a certain input and then I will get a certain output, with the system. So put instead of my DMRG code for simulation of many-body system, just the experiment with my system. I try a certain pulse, I measure certain population, and I feed it back in. Of course, this is classical feedback. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the same effect applies, and this suggests to me that I fully understand the reason why you try to get rid of some quick degrees of freedom. And I understand that there are a lot of situations in which this is, you know, not only the only sensible, only possible thing to do, but very sensible. It was fantastically. What my question is: are maybe there? I have the impression there are maybe situations in which those quicker degrees of freedom are not so unimportant after all, because they are those that make the difference between being able to achieve a certain task and not being able to do so, both in open and closed loop. Okay? So this is for me a little bit the open question, and your very insightful comment, okay, does not disambiguate completely, for me at least, this question.
I mean, the question probably rephrased as, when do we use adiabatic elimination? When should we use it?
Yeah, that's
interesting.
Oh,
thank you. Yeah, maybe I can read and say what you're, restate what you're trying to say and the way I understand it. And forget control. Just say, let's just say I have a dynamical system. When do I do adiabatic elimination there? Or any kind of model reduction? I have to analyze the time scales involved and figure out what I can actually eliminate, right? And I get a reduced model. But now when I introduce control, instead of working with the reduced model that I got in the absence of control and just plugging in control, which is what you would do when you're rotating wave approximation calculations that you showed, I should really go back to the original system and look at the new dynamics when I introduce control, right? I can bring in new dynamics which invalidates my original adiabatic elimination.
And so answers this question and says, when should we use it? Maybe when we have a situation with control, it arises a situation in which we wouldn't want to eliminate
it. Right, there could be situations. So that example.
Yeah, yeah. This is what I would have liked to be able to say. Yes.
May I just interject one point? Just in terms of for this open loop, I'm sorry, closed loop control, the adiabatic limit that we're, adiabatic limit that we heard about, would that change if the bath were non-Markovian? Because in some, as an example here for Tommaso, he wanted to make use of the memory kernel in order to achieve certain tasks. So how would that change?
Right.
This is also an answer to the Wang question.
You sort of struggle with the notion of non-Markoviality because we know what's Markov, right? And we know what we can do to make extend this in a non-Markovian way. And different people mean different things when they talk about non-Markovian, right? And it's not necessarily the same thing. So I think your non-Markovian was having a bath with this J density, which was
had a free, it was not white.
Wasn't it flat?
It was not white.
So that was probably like part of the noise.
Yeah.
So I should maybe introduce myself. I'm Matt Jane. I've just arrived from Australia yesterday, so I'm slightly, maybe a little bit jet lagged, but not too bad. I did manage to get a good sleep, but I'm a bit slow off the mic this morning, so that's why I came in a little bit late. So, but anyway, I guess I did. I guess Thomas, you asked me to give a talk, which I guess I'll probably do next week sometime.
Yes, we will. Yeah, we'll talk to you about the what we said was scheduled later. But thank you. Yes.
So I'm not quite sure what to comment on at the moment. I guess we'll have plenty of opportunities to discuss things. And I didn't get the first part of your talk and everything, but maybe I'll just make a few remarks if that would be helpful, if that's the purpose of the discussion. So.
Yes, please.
So I guess if you think about the history of control engineering, right, which goes back even further in history than the steam engine, right, where the, you know, James Watt used the governor to, you know, improve the performance of the steam engine. You know, feedback is really the central idea of control, right? So without feedback, and, you know, there's not much to do in terms of control, right? And the reason why feedback is important is because generally systems that are operating, in, you know, whether it's a quantum system or a classical system, is subject to uncertainty. You may not know a good model, right? There may be fluctuations and variations and so on, and noise and things like that. So, for example, in the case of a steam engine, you've got the steam engine trying to pump water and the water flow might fluctuate, or it's trying to drive an industrial process and the industrial process may have lows which change over time and so on. And so feedback is meant to automatically compensate for those things. And so the whole reason for control really flows from feedback, I think. I mean, open loop control might be used, for example, if you want to put, you know, a spacecraft on the moon, you work out the trajectory in an open loop kind of fashion, and you work out how to, you know, work out the trajectory for the spacecraft and where to do all the points of turn and so on, and where to fire the thrusters and all that sort of stuff. But as you're going, you might need to do some corrections, right? That's where feedback would come in. You work out where you are, and then maybe you make some adjustments accordingly. You know, airlines do that when they fly from Sydney to Los Angeles. They work out their flight path depending on the weather conditions, and then
waiters do it when they're rushing around with
their trays and so on. So feedback is really just a fundamental part of control engineering, and it's, I think, if we just look at the point of history now in terms of development of quantum technology, in a sense, open loop is the easiest kind of control, and it's okay in certain kinds of applications like NMR and so on. It's the one that's been the most relevant for quantum technology. But I think if we move forward a decade or two in history, we'll look back upon this as being an early part of quantum developments. And so it would be surprising to me to be, you know, say 10 or 20 years in the future and looking back and thinking that feedback is not just the standard part of quantum technology. I think it's just a historical development of things.
The open loop controller, though, I wouldn't completely agree that this is as important to the design of quantum technologies currently. I mean, it's a challenge if you're in a large dimensional Hilbert space often to design a particular, say, unitary or whatever map you want to make on your system, given certain Hamiltonians that you have access to. You may not have universal access. Oh, I just want to do this unitary. And so designing a particular map on a system, I'm not sure if this is different in the quantum world versus the classical world. I mean, Newton's laws or maybe, you know, getting
I think it is.
I think there is a harder challenge here. So there is, I think there are important questions in open loop. It's not to say that control won't ultimately be in it really important as well, because we won't be able to achieve the open loop control to the degree of accuracy that we like in the same way that we need to make adjustments. But the open loop is not just, it's my opinion that open loop is truly important as well.
That's right. So I think it depends on how you think about these things, because the way I think about what's commonly referred to as open loop in the quantum community would be more like a top-level supervisor that provides some instructions every now and then to the physical system. Mm-hmm. So it's like the, you know, NASA giving the overall flight trajectory to the mission, right? But then locally, you know, you might have some feedback going on. So for example, you know, when you're you know, applying a unitary at a certain time through some pulse actions, you're initiating certain interactions. So at the level of the physical system, you've got, you know, you're engaging certain couplings, and effectively that's like doing sort of coherent feedback at the level of the physical system. And so your open loop controller is effectively like a top level supervisor that occasionally engages these physical interactions. And those physical interactions are directional, bidirectional couplings between systems or subsystems. And that's effectively feedback at that local level. So while at the local level you've got feedback going on, at the top level you've got an open loop activity going on.
But now I'm confused, and this comes from my ignorance here, because if I have a many-body system, which is also part of the topic of today's discussion, It seems to me, I mean, the way I understood or maybe misunderstood what you said is I give a recipe, someone gives a recipe to Emmanuel Bloch and says, Emmanuel, do this. Yeah. Emmanuel does it, and while he is doing it, of course, it is a many-body system and the guys will talk to each other.
Yeah.
But this is not, maybe again due to my ignorance, something I would have called feedback, because for me, feedback would be, as you said, you know, the space shuttle is going a little bit in the wrong direction, I'm seeing it, let me correct it. And instead, the way I view these algorithms are stupid, right? They do not know what to do, they just do what happens, you know, due to interactions. And so, yes, they talk to each other in a quantum way, and yes, of course, they react to each other in the sense that if someone does something, the other atom will do something as a consequence. But I mean, this is just dynamics, right? Because it is determined from, you know, what I prescribed in the beginning. So this is not something I would have called feedback in this sense. But okay, or maybe I misunderstood that you called it feedback. Maybe you meant something else.
Maybe a couple of comments on that. So, yes. So very often when you pick up a textbook on, you know, an undergraduate textbook on control, you'll see, you know, flow charts that have directional arrows, right? Inputs and outputs and so and things like that. And certainly a lot of control theory has been developed on this kind of signal-based paradigm, right? Where you have an input signal and an output signal. And, you know, like if you've got a cruise control on a car, you measure your velocity and you compare that with your set point, and then you adjust the accelerator to, you know, make sure that you stay at a constant speed, right? And so that's a very simple way of thinking about control. It's not the only way of thinking about control.
Okay.
So if you think about, say, the, you know, again, if you go right back into history and look at the steam engine and the governor, you can think about that as just two mechanical systems that were bolted together and they're interacting. So is the governor the system or the controller? Is the steam engine the system or the controller? It's a kind of a symmetric relationship, and you're not necessarily decoupling it into an input and an output. You're just talking about two physical systems that have been engineered to cooperate together to achieve your, you know, your regulated behavior.
See, this is again why it was worthwhile to try so many mindset of engineers.
Yeah. So there are lots of ways of thinking about these.
I have a comment attached to this conversation, which is, I'll call it the defense of open loop for quantum systems. And it really, in the quantum world, it's different. And it's different because of the challenge of having, for the closed loop systems, enough information in the governor object, the object which is going to provide the feedback, so that it can actually do its job while still allowing for a sufficiently interesting remaining Hilbert space, unaffected Hilbert space, that quantum stuff can happen. And this is the type of challenge which, at the moment, and in the sort of foreseeable future, we don't have good answers for.
Can I interject?
Yeah.
Because now I fully subscribe to what he says, but I would like to say something in defense of what I understood of what he is saying.
In defense of feedback.
No, this is really what,
to be quite honest, I think it's kind of a pointless debate, really.
Yeah.
But it's not about defending.
The thing is, the control engineering is about engineering dynamics, right?
Yeah.
That's the fundamental objective.
Sure.
Where you have high-level supervisors giving occasional instructions and then having your engineering, the dynamics that are fully quantum mechanical, that's all part of the whole task of engineering the dynamics. So you think about control as being engineering dynamics to get the system to do what you want it to do. That's all that's important.
Right.
And I think what we need to do is we pull together, you know, ideas from different disciplines. What we've got to ask ourselves, well, what from our discipline is really relevant to what it is that I really want to do with this physical system, right? Whether it's making a quantum computer or, you know, sharing quantum information through a network or whatever the objective might be. So I think what we should be doing is just putting aside our discipline backgrounds for a little bit and think, well, what is it that we really want to do? You know, do we want to build a quantum memory, which is what a lot of our work is doing at the moment at ANU? Do we want to build a network of quantum devices? Do we want to build a computer? Or do we want to have a precise measurement system? Or whatever the objective might be, that's the fundamental thing. And then we think, well, what from physics is relevant to doing that? And we remember that in physics, of course, the tradition is understanding the natural world, and traditional engineering is building the artificial world, if you like. Synthesis versus analysis, right? But pull together the relevant bits from the different areas, not just your favorite set of tools that you've grown up with. I mean, we're all like to pull those things into what we're doing now, but, right? And then think about, well, what's relevant from different areas, and what new techniques need to be developed? And that's really, I think, one of our main goals.
No, but for me, this is not just which techniques are useful, it's also which concepts are useful.
No,
I make an example, in the sense that what you said, I would have viewed, you know, this optical lucky system like, you know, just open loop. And you say, no, it is closed loop because things talk to each other, right?
Yeah.
And now you brought a concept which is now, I think, is shedding some light for me, because this metaphor, which you also showed the other day, of the engine and this Watt's regulator, I mean, somehow you say it is a, overall a dynamical system, and you know, there is some pullback force that you know, pulls back some things in a linear way, whatever you like. And now it makes me think, yes, also in my optical lattice situation, I do have an external harmonic confinement, right? And this external harmonic confinement is something that somehow is keeping the particles together in my register that I want to achieve. And so this is maybe, if I understood correctly, an example of what you say when you say particles talk to each other, in the sense that this confinement is pulling them together, and it makes such that there is one here, and he will talk to the other guy, so that they form an ordered array. And this is, I mean, I can view this, of course, as some way in which I have structured my system to get the best possible objective, but it helps conceptually to think, okay, here is, I mean, my control parameter, my knobs, is not just the time dependence, is, I mean, whatever I can do so that the system by itself, you know, goes in a certain direction.
But you don't change the form of the harmonic confinement. That's fixed.
The thing is, what I'm suggesting is, I could probably use that also, I could change that shape,
yeah,
to better achieve some goal. In fact, in some ion chains,
Right?
We had this conversation, because in some ion crystals, self-assembled crystals, you would like to have a regular array, but this is not really what you get if you have harmonic confinement. And now you are putting your Watt's you know, rotating guy, in the sense that now you will design your potential in a different way, not harmonic, but somehow, you know, more flat in the at the bottom, so that you have a longer region self-assembled of, you know, equally spaced things. And for me, at least, viewing this, you know, with in mind your Watt's engine, you mean this is opening a door in my mind, let's say, which is not just, you know, I have a goal, I want to achieve it, what are the best tools? No, but what are also the concepts, that where do they come from?
Right?
So this was very helpful, all you said, at least for me. And this is, you know, we have also to, you know, to say, I'm a physicist, I want to learn from engineers, right? Yeah. So it is not just about problems, it's about also, I mean, this...
when I referred to, you know, figuring out the right methods, I also meant implicitly, I guess, the concepts.
Right.
I mean, the very first quantum problem that I worked on, and maybe that's what I'll talk about when I give my little lecture, it was almost impossible to formulate properly and solve in the standard way of physics. Right. I mean, and so, you know, I had to use, shift away from the Schrodinger picture and formulate things properly in the Heisenberg picture, and that allowed me to move forward. So just looking at things in a slightly different way, I mean, physics is the same, but, you know, looking at things in the Heisenberg picture made the whole problem much more natural. And so there's lots of things like that that are relevant. It's like, you know, choosing coordinates. If you choose the wrong coordinates, your matrix is all messy, right? But if you choose, you know, the right basis, you'll make it have a nice structure, like diagonal or whatever. So I think that's part of the conceptual thinking as well.
Maybe just a quick comment on non-Markovianity.
Yeah, that would be good.
I don't know if it'd be good, but
that may be good.
It's possibly the case that just looking at the what Hideo Noguchi now calls the SL and H formalism. That I presented yesterday. They're, for most part, the SL and H were just fixed operators on your system space. But there's nothing to stop you having these being replaced by adapted processes. Adapted just means they depend on the noise that's entered your system up to whatever particular time, for each instant of time. So it gets back to what Mohan was saying about you know, when you're checking the dynamics, you have to allow for the fact that you're rejigging your equation so that in the unitary, so that the coefficients can actually depend on past history, right? And much of the algebra I showed you yesterday will turn out to be exactly the same.
Right? What about your
that's not Markovian.
What about your BAT? Your Wiener operators.
Yeah.
That were white noise. What if
that means that, you know, somehow there's external noise coming in which we're modeling as white?
Yeah. So what if it were not?
Again, it may well pass through several filters which color it before it actually gets to the system of interest. And of course you can combine the coloring filters with your system.
Yeah, just a couple of comments on that one. So I think the right way to think about things like the Wiener process, whether it's classical or quantum, is as an idealization, right? So it's like in physics, it's like if you want to study the motion of a particle, you use a point mass, right? So you don't worry about the detail. If you're looking at the dynamics of the cannonball, you don't look at the dynamics of each and every molecule in the cannonball, right? That'd be too complicated. But you just look at the center of mass and calculate the trajectory in that way. And so doing that kind of thing is a very common paradigm in science, is that you look at some very simple, tractable tool, and when a process is like that. But of course, you know, this is not a quantum thing, it happens in the classical world all the time, is that very often your processes that are occurring in your physical system, whether it's an aircraft or whatever it might be, may not be white, right? And it happens in statistics all the time. And so what you do is you try to represent it. So you want to represent things in the white noise, because that has a really nice calculus, right? That's what calculus was invented for. That's why we have Newton's laws of motion, you know, expressed in terms of differential calculus, right? Because the calculus is tractable, right? We don't have discretized models of physics, right? We use differential models of physics. We do the discretization and we want to program it on the computer, right? And so so if you have a physical process, whether it's quantum or classical, that's not white, then typically what you're trying to do is you try to represent that process as being the output of something which was driven by white. So in other words, you add in the dynamics to color the noise in the right way. And that's a typical engineering paradigm. It's a very common thing. You see what's called whitening filters. And so what you do is you augment your physical system with a module that processes the environment noise and shapes it in a way that is physically relevant for you. But ultimately what you end up with is a composite model, the system plus the noise generator, if you like, but it's driven by something that's canonical, something that's very natural and very simple to work with. And that's why you do it. This goes back to people like Norbert Wiener, you know, who's one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century. He was doing this kind of thing in the 1920s or thereabouts, right? So there are very deep ideas for doing these things, and they're very much rooted in the common paradigm of science and engineering, that you try to work with canonical tools, of which the Wiener process and the Poisson process are two examples. So that's the way I would see it.
So for instance, cascading a system, first of all, with, just say, a harmonic oscillator, the output from the oscillator, if you put in vacuum noise, so these quantum-like noises, the output will be some Onstein-Uhlenbeck process. You can then consider non-Uhlenbeck process as driving a system. And probably just raising the point of Wiener. Wiener, of course, developed famously his theory of filtering, which was just for white sense stationary processes, not necessarily Markov, right? It was only later that Kalman developed the Kalman filter, which was a state-based model based on typically Wiener noise coming in. Similarly, Stratonovich, I guess, in USSR. Both of these helped put their respective countries up into space and land on the moon and do various things. But actually dealing with, white sense stationary processes, but having a non-flat spectrum actually predates the work of Kalman's state-based. that's Wiener.
That's right.
I'm not actually aware of anyone having done a quantum Wiener filter.
The model reduction is really part of the connection to Tommaso's discussion about the questions about adiabatic elimination and when, not what should we, but when should we, or can we, is the model reduction go through similarly? Are there modifications?
That's right. If the we is quantum control engineers, the question really should be, when do quantum control engineers use adiabatic elimination?
When is it a good approximation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's fun.
Yes. Right.
And I don't know, I think many of us here were also in Bonn last year in January. Mm-hmm. And I have a little bit of a deja vu in terms of the discussion now, because it's moved towards the discussion between open loop and closed loop, which we had several times there as well. And I think it's really interesting, but originally our discussion subject for today was quantum reservoir engineering, right? And in any case, because I'm the wiki master, I have a suggestion which I would find interesting, which is to create a wiki page where we have a sort of table which lists the different requirements and assumptions for both techniques, so that, because I think there are many different interesting aspects that were mentioned today, but I would like to have a kind of complete list where these two methods can really be compared in a fair way. I don't know if anyone would be interested in participating in creating such a...
But again, I think I'd really...
Like where we say, you know, we need a continuous time, and we need Markovian assumption, we need void noise, or we don't, and we need unitary systems, and here we have a Hilbert space which is exponentially large, here we don't, here we have a Lie algebraic approach, and so on, you know, just to have a kind of...
So once again, I think... It's kind of pointless having a debate about one or the other, right? I mean, if you walked into a control conference and started debating the benefits of feedback and open loop, it just wouldn't gain any traction. And I don't think quantum mechanics is that different, that it's going to make one more, you know, make open loop more important ultimately. Because after all, you know, open loop is a special case of feedback, right?
Well, if we had a feedback, Thomas was talking about
concepts, right? So in terms of logical structure of concepts, then open loop is a special case of feedback, right?
Yes, but we don't have a feedback theory
I think we should have
open loop inside.
Yes, we do, in fact. We can talk about that here. But what's most important is to focus on the engineering of dynamics. That's what control is all about. And if you need, you know, something that we might call open loop today to do it, then by all means do it. If you need what's analogous to the steam engine regulator, then by all means do it. But, you know, that's what I mean by pulling together the appropriate tools to make the specific objective of what you're trying to do.
I am tempted to use my privilege of having a useless microphone for this registration to say that, to interject for Jake, to say that perhaps this could be, it is true that this is a little bit off topic from the topic that we chose today, which was the embodying on Markov server engineering, but it could be the subject of a subsequent discussion for next week, right? Which, for instance, we could think of organizing. This sounds very much like that. Maybe some people think this is necessary, some other people think such a discussion is utterly useless, and so we have a more interesting discussion. This is how I would suggest it.
We thought about having it on Friday, right?
Well, I thought that, we could have it on Friday. There was also, yesterday you had a suggestion that on Friday we could focus on open questions from the talks of John and Hendra.
It could be appended to that.
That's right. And that we can see what happens on Friday. It could be probably also tomorrow there will be talks and people will have reactions to that and we won't have enough time, so maybe like it could even be that every Friday, but we have to discuss it, maybe every Friday it could be just sort of wrap up the discussion of, you know, all items that have come up in the week and maybe prepare for the coming week. So if we have enough time on Friday to discuss on this, fine, otherwise we can schedule it for next week, yeah? So this could be, and just to say that Friday should not be just for the two of them, but maybe also tomorrow's speakers. They will have questions that need to be addressed further. Now, Jake wanted to say something.
So, I mean, suggest as a topic of discussion going forward that there is a missing piece in the closed loop puzzle to make all of the power of closed loop control from classical systems be available to us for quantum systems. And that's the ability to work with back action and back action free types of connections. So it comes back to the problem that when I want to make a closed loop, I have an exterior subsystem, and that exterior subsystem can learn information about my quantum system, which is basically what I wanted to work in. And so the tools for describing back action or lack of back action are rudimentary at best, and I would say not yet up to the task, allowing us to do some serious engineering in the closed loop sector. So that's sort of I would say, a missing piece that maybe we can try and, you know.
I can give you lots of comments on that. I'm not sure whether now's the right time or not.
It's just something to broader discussion going forward.
Yeah, so I just have a few comments and maybe one question for Tommaso, I guess. So I'll just start with Ivan's question about this non-microbial bath. And so I was having this discussion with Andrew Doherty a few months back, and I haven't seen the literature, but apparently there are some people in physics who are implementing this whole filtering idea so you embed this work by Attach Imamoglu. So, but I haven't seen the reference myself, so this was something that came up, that Andrew mentioned to me. So, depending on what the spectral density of the bath is, you could probably model it as a Markovian noise that's driven into some system, oscillator system, something that produces that spectral density at the output. So I think there is something existing in the literature. And if you do that so you can embed it in a Markovian system, then what I talked about yesterday would apply to the larger embedding in that case. So I had a question about how open loop experiments are done. So basically, the point of having feedback is that, you know, you can reduce sensitivity to uncertainties in your system. So basically, if you know your system perfectly, you know, there are no uncertainty, and you know your parameters perfectly, then, you know, open loop is really, you know, I mean, you don't have the benefit of feedback if you have a perfect model for your system.
But there's also robust open loop control. You can design, depending on the nature of your system, you can design an open loop controller which is somewhat robust to a certain set of uncertainties.
Sure. Yes.
And maybe not in all contexts, but in certain contexts.
Yes. So I guess what my question is, so in this experience, is that the case where you have very good model of your system, and that, are there, what are the effects of certain discrepancy in your model when you apply this open loop? I mean, is that significant, or there's no?
It's always significant.
It's always significant.
And it's always a very good description of the system, in the sense that we're talking about, you know, for instance, ultra-cold systems. I mean, systems in which are doing quantum control are systems which are very well known. And so every time you are setting yourself a goal, which is more difficult than what you can achieve, okay? And so it is something which would have been unconceivable 4 years ago, right? Like single atom detection, for instance. But now you have it, and you want to do something much more accurate, right? And which means that you are going to probe the further uncertainties that you have. This is valid for all systems, including for superconducting systems. For instance, now you can do things that one would think impossible a few years ago, and it means I am going to probe the next generation. So I would like to have, for instance, an array of such superconducting qubits, which I would like to be completely equal to one another, and they are not. And so, I mean, I always will need this robustness, just on higher orders, so to say.
I mean, I think I would quote Donald Rumsfeld's most brilliant contribution to the universe, which is there are the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. So if you know that there are going to be certain set of inhomogeneities in the system, then you might be able to design your open loop system accordingly to be robust to, you know, for example, in an atomic system, you know you're not going to be tuned exactly at the right level, and you can. This in NMR, they do this all the time, right? They have their inhomogeneous control. But if there are other things that come in that you, the unknown unknowns, then you certainly feedback, you better have that, otherwise, right. It's not going to work.
Right. I'm too much about this when you should do. The other point of more, I mean, what I talked about yesterday was, you know, it's going to model reduction. So the reason that people do model reduction is that, first of all, it can reduce the complexity of your design goals. And also the other one is that, you know, you can get if you have a very high order model, then you get a very high order controller as well. So people try to avoid that. But of course, if you can work with the original model rather than a reduced one, you can do more, right? Because you have more information about your pattern. It's natural, of course, you don't want, if you could do that, then you wouldn't do the adiabatic elimination. I mean, you could perform, you could do a bit better control, you have a better model of your plan, right?
Sorry, I think you made it very clear in your talks, and I didn't by any means imply with my question that what you did is not good. It is very clear the motivation, it is very clear how it is useful and interesting, and my question is more, I mean, are there situations in which there is more, okay, there is something which is more interesting, which, you know, maybe cannot be captured by this model reduction, but still can be useful in terms of control.
Yeah, no, so that's what I'm agreeing with you. So I'm not disagreeing. So what I'm saying is, if you can have a full model, you probably want to use a full model, including all the higher order frequency, and then you would expect to be able to do better control.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's what I'm not disagreeing with you on that. And about this, you mentioned that you can do, you're doing feedback with open loop in one experiment. Are you actually measuring something and then feeding
yes.
it back?
So basically my open loop thing is, I try a pulse shape. Mm-hmm. I give it to my computer. Mm-hmm. Computer says, in an experiment, this is what will come out.
Right.
And then I iterate. So it is a closed loop in which my open loop is an iterative closed loop algorithm where, you know, the system is replaced by a simulation, and it is open loop in the sense that there is no physical system in the loop.
Okay, I see.
Okay, now and this is my open loop calculation. Mm-hmm. Iterative improvement, you know, and then I get something. My closed loop is where I take this computer, I throw it away, and I put some atoms or superconducting qubits in there, and then I give some pulse shape, I do the experiment, I measure something, and I iterate. Okay, so it has exactly the same structure. For in my language, open or closed loop only means in my iteration loop, is there an actual physical system or just a simulation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. So in your case, just simulation then?
In the cases I presented, yes, but my algorithm, unlike other gradient-based algorithm, mm-hmm. my CRAB algorithm can be implemented in a closed-loop system feedback on experiment, okay? And there are, I have not shown them, but there are experimental results which are showing that this converges and it is working well for them.
All right, I think we're about at the time. So maybe we should use this model as the opportunity to thank Tommaso for initiating this very nice discussion. And we need closed loop here, so we need your feedback in terms of how this forum works. I mean, is this the right thing for us in terms of this work? The structure, generally speaking.